Welcome into This Has to Work. I'm Matt Hodelin. Joining me today is Brian Alvarez Bailey. Brian is a mentor, fintech influencer, podcast host, and founder of Allison, a banking as a service platform that equips businesses with the digital tools required to launch a product. Allison's platform helps community banks and credit unions do business with fintech companies that are traditionally hard to bank because of know your customer, anti-money laundering, otherwise known as KYC, AML, and other regulatory hurdles. Allison helps fintech companies access traditional bank services and supports banks that want to do more compliant business with fintech and non-traditional companies. First, welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
So I'm trying to distill banking as a service into its simplest explanation. How badly did I screw up that description? So
I was going to say, I've one thing that just jumped out to me is that I've indoctrinated you well.
Okay.
Tried to educate you on the intricacies of regulatory policy and procedure. But that's really the unique thing is that you take this regulatory body, right? The federal government, state governments, they say, hey, you have to do thing X. More importantly, you have to constantly review and change and scrutinize thing X because we reserve the right at any point to say, hey, even though we didn't tell you not to do this, you did this, and now we're going to spank you for it. And so there comes it has to move from reactive to proactive at that point.
Well, and it's not like they give you three strikes and you're out. Correct. Or a slap on the wrist. Like, this stuff has real consequences. That's right. if you mess it up, if you get it wrong.
Multiple millions of dollars. And also, I like the fact that you pointed out that our customer avatar very much is the backbone of the U.S. economy, which are smaller and localized banks who, by all metrics, don't have the money to throw away for fines and statutes and things like that. So they have to doubly be careful when it comes to those things.
Yeah, and that risk aversion is also, you know, translates into which lines of business are they willing to engage in? How are they willing to engage in those things? And so that kind of is where Allison comes in, and we'll get to that in a second. But I want to just make sure that we're kind of level setting for the audience here. So Allison is the product name. It's not some human being we're talking about. To confuse everybody when we're referring to that. But first, real quick, tell the audience, why did you name the product Allison?
So originally so my background is in building financial applications, right? I've done it for smaller banks. I've done it for fintech companies. This was something that I've been doing for a long time. And I was at a fintech company that was trying to work with a smaller bank, right? Because ultimately, if the smaller bank has the licenses and statutes that fintech company needs, okay, well, hey, let's partner. You have something I need. I have something that I can pay you for. Great. Now we're in a transaction. The problem is that because this fintech company is ahead of this bank in terms of innovation, they have an application that can't actually talk directly to that bank, right? So now we have to spend... It took us like 2 years to get connected to that bank because they had to have oversight, mm-hmm, over our transactions. So we had to build something that they could use to do that. So we built them this tool that they years later went and monetized without that company. But I said there had to be an easier way to do this. So that was sort of the genesis of what became eventually Allison. It had a very non-cool marketing name. Like I'm very just sort of functional, right?
Yeah.
Like I took one thing and put it together. And I knew long-term that wasn't going to work. Actually, I have a really good friend, Julie Gile. She's the chief technical officer for a company called Clear, another fintech company out of New York. And she was sort of walking me through the steps that they took to come to that name, right? And so doing my own research, setting up, you know, campaigns with various research tools, I discovered that feminine sounding or feminine connoting names have more trust with people who are bank adjacent or in banking. So if it has a feminine sounding name, like I trust this more than a masculine sounding name. So I said, okay, let's make it something feminine. And just happy accidents as they always tend to happen. I was having dinner with my grandmother and she reminded me that in 1989, I wrote a paper about this black lady who was the first black lady invited to the White House press corps, the congressional press corps, Allison Dunnigan. And so she said, why don't you use a combination of that? And I was like, I don't even remember that. How do you remember something from that long ago? I was like, I had to be like six. So anyway, it's just some little cute little thing that she remembered. And so testing out Alice and Allison, Alice, for whatever reason, trended positively like 50 some odd percent of the time. Allison actually trended positively like 90% of the time, which again, to this day, I'm telling you, Matt, I don't know like the psychology that goes into that. I just know that at that point I needed a name, and that was the one that we went with.
So how did you get the idea to start Allison? Like, and maybe more specifically, I mean, you're an ambitious, you're a capable guy. You have all the kind of skill sets to be a successful founder. So you could have gone in a lot of different directions. So where did you get the idea for Allison, and maybe more broadly, why spend your time in the fintech sector?
Right. So working for a fintech company and founding a fintech company, though I'm utilizing essentially the same skill, it's diametrically different North Stars, right? Like I'm helping to build something that's either that either has hit the market and had a good amount of traction, therefore they can afford to hire a person like me to come in and tune things, versus building something completely from scratch, right? And so for me, going through the pain of having to connect to that bank years ago, it was large enough pain that I felt there had to be more people out there that experienced it. And then once I just started just doing, you know, again, I'm not even talking traditional quote unquote customer discovery. This was me just picking up the phone and talking to people in my network. I'm like, hey, have you gone through this problem? Like, what are you guys using to solve this problem? Well, we don't have anything. I said, but if you had this, like, would that help? Like, oh man, where can I find that? Oh, I'm building this. And so it was more so just getting the initial validation from my peers of, hey, if you had something that could do this, I would pay you money for it.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, well, if that's the smallest investment that I have to make, let's what's the next milestone, right? Like, let's build something very lightweight, like not even MVP. Let's just build a prototype. And I put that in front of those people, and they're like, yeah, we would pay for this. Like, we would sign something that says we commit to using this if this actually worked. And so just going through that process of figuring out each sort of small step to say, yes, you will take the next 10 years of your life to building this thing, right? Whether it becomes something, whether it doesn't, this is a journey that you're willing to go on, because there's enough for me to learn, just as, because my thing is always, am I going to learn something?
Mm-hmm.
That isn't the sort of the bottom line execution point, but it plays a big part in my decision making. So it was like, okay, you're going to learn a whole lot, because I've worked for startups most of my career outside of working for a bank. I've never like actually like been in charge of directing the course, right? From organizational standpoint. So I felt like that was a challenge that I needed at the time.
Yeah.
Now, as you can see, I've got a ton of gray hair on my face, which I didn't have last year, which should tell you that, you know, it is an extremely challenging enterprise. But that's what I enjoy that. Like, I enjoy that process. I enjoy the process of being able to talk to folks like you and say, hey, I don't think I'm really grasping this. Like, how are you seeing this? And then either being shown, here's a pathway you could take.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you and I talked a long time ago about the fish diagram mentality, where if blocked here, go left. If blocked here, go right. There is no real manual to this, so everywhere you go, you're gonna get input, and it's gonna tell you where to go next.
Sure,
that's literally how I've been doing it. So for me, Allison has been a journey of both discovery from a personal standpoint, but really more so on the regulatory standpoint, right? Because I mean, last year the roof kind of caved in on fintech when SVB went down, because now federal regulators are like, hey, wait a minute, you banks are doing what with who? And these are not companies that you own or companies that you have skin in the game with, and they're controlling your compliance? What? Like, no. So, I mean, I think for us, for the Allison team, it's been an opportunity to better entrench ourselves in the idea that we want to help these smaller banks stay compliant and stay on the right side of the law.
Right.
Right? Because clearly there's a national zeitgeist movement, if you will, of, hey, we want to make sure that we keep our consumers protected. Though we don't have consumer customers, we're an extension of that, because we've built this application layer to support organizations that have millions of consumers.
Yeah, and Allison so is essentially just that, right? It's a platform that allows fintech and community banks, fintech companies and community banks to do business together. But I think sometimes we'll all get stuck in the semantics or the definitions. But again, just to, for the audience sake, when we talk about a fintech company and we talk about a community bank, what are we talking about? Like, what does that look like?
Right. So a fintech company is going to typically be a company that builds some app or service and puts it in the hands of the consumers that makes their financial lives easier. Hard stop, right? Like I want to move money faster. I want to move more money. I want to move it to people across borders. That's really what a fintech company is, right? They're creating something that makes a consumer's life easier as it relates to their money. Not often does the idea of innovation and the idea of oversight, oftentimes innovation will outpace oversight. So now you have the bank as the oversight body, the extension of the government, and they say, okay, fintech company, you've built this cool little app to serve these customers. By extension, they then become our customers. So we now have a fiduciary duty to ensure that we're keeping them protected from fraud, allowing the wrong type of illegal folks to bank, either terrorists or different things like that. Like a lot of terrorism cells are funded through money laundering that go directly to these smaller banks. So they have a mandate to truncate and mitigate that risk as much as possible. So now you're asking this, you know, kind of traditional party to now have oversight of this agile, innovative team. Like that's a hard mix. But through the innovation, you can then create tools, which is what Allison is effectively doing, that can help that traditional business have oversight of this innovative company. It's saying, okay, we'll give you the muscle to match their innovation. Right.
So one of the things that has made this traditionally hard for these banks to do business with those types of companies is exactly that regulatory environment.
Correct.
You said. And what I've always found interesting about kind of the fintech sector, banking as a service more specifically, is that that's the one place where innovation isn't allowed to outpace the oversight. Like everywhere else, we seem to be okay with it. Like, honestly, if you compared healthcare and innovation,
that's right,
or banking and fintech and innovation, I feel like the oversight happens before the innovation is allowed,
right,
in fintech, maybe even more so than in healthcare. And then I just think about AI in general. And now everybody on Capitol Hill is like, you know, wringing their hands and clutching their pearls and saying, what are we supposed to do about this thing that's going to take over and become sentient and, you know, run the world, and we're trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
That's right.
But it's like, I want to do card not present for a pharmacy transaction online. Absolutely not. You cannot do that. I don't care if you have the technology, the oversight's not there. We don't know how to regulate it. Therefore you can't do it.
Correct.
So traditionally all of these things have come in and made it difficult for those two entities to do business. You mentioned this around, and it's a little bit about, when we say KYC, we mean know your customer, bunch of regulations on there. I'm not going to go into the plumbing of that because everybody's tuning out at that point. I would too, probably.
That's what the innovation opportunity
is. Yeah, if I wasn't such a nerd about this stuff, I would tune out as well. But stick with us here for just a second. To that point, there's not just the regulatory environment, but there's also too around all of the different technologies that have to go in this, and we'll unpack some of those. But given that innovation, given all the technology, the tech stack that Allison utilizes to make the plumbing work, how are you balancing that with UX, UI, ease of use for these entities, to your point, that may or may not even have mobile banking available via app to their customers today?
So I'm glad you said that. Let's look at that for a second. You mean to tell me that there are banks out there in 2024 that can't even allow a customer to, from their phone, open up an account? Yes, most of them, in fact, right? Like this was something that was completely illustrative to me as well, where I'm like actually talking to these banking entities. So originally, Allison started off as strictly, quote unquote, banking as a service, right? The ability for a fintech company to operate legally by partnering them with the community, with a smaller local bank. Simple premise. As we started to onboard with our first banks, we discovered, well, wait a minute. It's not just the inability for you to onboard a quote unquote non-traditional fintech customer. You can't even onboard traditional customers. There's a deeper problem here. So going back to your point about the plumbing, if it all starts with knowing who the depositor is, and when we say no, we're just talking about the publicly available information, the information that they've opted into providing us. We need to make sure that A, the information they've given us is accurate, right? Known to be accurate toward the individual or business. B, once we've identified that it's accurate, we need to make sure that this person or entity hasn't been attached to anything criminally related to financial crime, right? They haven't done anything that, you know, would put the antennas of a bank up, right? There's a C there also, going back to what you were talking about. We also then have to make it easy for that bank, when they do find individuals that are engaged in bad things and they've already let that individual inside their bank, to then report it to that regulatory body to say, hey, we signed up this individual. We've just discovered, you know, in real time that they've been attached to some sort of terrorism cell or they've done some sort of money laundering. Now, and we've stopped their access, we've turned them off, and we're reporting this to you as our regulatory body, right? FDIC, right? So this goes back to your point about people in Congress being concerned with their inability to regulate these things, because that's the other part of it is, even if they say, hey, let's put in buttresses that can capture these things, are we confident that the actual banks are going to tell us when something slips through the cracks? That those edge cases are really what scares them, because edge cases could be responsible for billions and billions of, excuse me, edge cases are responsible for billions and billions of dollars of what they would call fraud leakage, right? Mm-hmm. So monies that were fraudulently gotten that were not captured. And so all of those things combined play into why Allison has taken the position as the community bank's technical arm, right? Yep. We want to be an extension of everything that they do right. Not to say that we're this panacea or this, you know, some sort of magic pill that they can swallow, but we say, look, we want to put you on the path to keeping up with the potential short gaps that you may have. Well, at least if you know, we can then plan for them.
Yeah, and one of the things too, I think, is just important to point out is when you're talking about software and banking specific to transactions, the frictionless nature also lends to speed and potential severity for when one of those things goes wrong.
Right.
So all of a sudden, $100,000 or $1 million moves in a way it's not supposed to move, or maybe more importantly, between entities for which it's not supposed to move, and it happens in a fraction of a second because it is frictionless. So the stakes are just higher. Any way you cut it.
Right. And so this goes back to the question about UX. So what we've attempted to do is, rather than focus on creating experiences, we say, let's put the ugly and hard rules and guardrails in place, but then allow the fintech companies that are building these lush and lavish and frictionless onboarding experiences, let's allow them to benefit from the hard work that we did to make the plumbing work. So if you think of Allison as the plumbing, right? We let the artisans come in and build the porcelain toilets and with the bidets and all the cute, pretty things, right? Where you go into the house and say, oh man, this is beautiful. You don't really care how the plumbing works, quote unquote. You just care that it works. And I think that's where the true opportunity for us is to remain in the dirty spaces, because then we then allow the fintech companies to go out and build these pretty
right.
UIs and pretty UXs and pretty apps. Great. Have a ball. We will make sure that each and every time one of your users attempts to move some money, we will make sure they check every single regulatory box before they hit that submit button, before that money leaves from account X to account Y. We will make sure it checks all the boxes. And if it does not, we will not let the transaction move forward.
So you've been out in the market you know, you've had kind of release, you know, your MVP, you've had release 1.0, you've pretty much had release 2.0. I know you're working on a lot of things in the background, but the early response to Allison within the fintech community, what has that been like, and what feedback have you found valuable from those early users, those early customers?
Right. So going, I kind of alluded to it before, where we were working with a small community bank partner in Florida. And originally it was, they saw Allison just as an opportunity to get access to fintech deposits. That's all they wanted, right? From a board perspective, that was their mandate, right? They wanted new lines of revenue. What was apparent to me was so there's the idea of these new lines of revenue, but they didn't stop to ask themselves, hey, are we getting the available revenue from our current customers? To me, the answer was no, because again, they weren't doing things fundamentally like allowing their customers to sign up in less than, you know, 3 minutes, or allowing their customers to sign up from their phone, not having to go to in branch to deposit cash. I'm like, wait a minute. If you guys just did that, there would be so much cash. You know what? I'll give you your flowers. You told me something a while ago. You're like, Brian, I can't tell you how many startups I see that don't invest in retargeting. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? They don't invest in the fact that they're providing this value for their customers, and then trying to see what other value they can provide for those very same customers, getting more money from people that already trust you because they trust your value,
right?
And you're adding more value. Just apply that to a bank, right? Like if I say I'm going to give you $100 to deposit an account, I'm basically telling you that I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
Are you providing me every opportunity to get the most out of that money? Like, are you offering me different accounts? Are you offering me different types of money vehicles? The answer was no. And we were just, again, it was just us talking to their customers. It was like, hey, if you give us access to your customers, we'll tell you what they want and what they don't want. And it was almost like we were a marketing arm for this bank. But again, it was building trust for us, because they were like, hey, before we give you access to our core, like, show us some value. And that was the way that we were going to show value. But that was literally what we discovered, was that, hey, if you guys just do these fundamental things, and we can help you do it, but if you guys do these fundamental things, you can have this and this. And there is no real acquisition cost there, because you already got the customer. They already trust you.
Right. Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, because I know this is something that's important to you, and you and I have had conversations about this, but banking and fintech don't really have the best representation of women or people of color.
That's right.
And I know that it's important, not only just from a standpoint of looking at it in the macro and recognizing that we have opportunities to create better access, to create better opportunities and equitable outcomes in that space. But to you, why is it so important that diversity, you know, be a part of the Allison team, and how do you see that increasing the likelihood of the success of Allison over the longer term?
That is a really good question. So I'm going to be super honest, right? Like I'm not going to give you the sort of the political answer to it. The real answer is there's a ton of money to be made when you tap into these quote unquote diverse communities. And when I say diverse, I'm really just talking about having a customer avatar that is outside of your specific purview or mm-hmm. your specific lifestyle sort of viewpoint. And so, because again, as a black man, right, I've got black family members, right? I've got cousins and sisters and brothers and all these people that I'm related to that live a similar lifestyle. And they're always complaining to me about, I hate my bank, or I'm never getting a bank account. Why are you not getting a bank account? Why I don't trust the bank? Why don't you trust the bank? I just don't know. Okay. All right. That's a starting place. But it's like, I hear time and time again, these stories about sort of mistrust when it comes to financial institutions and or when it comes to technology. I ask myself, man, if you can tap, so if this is the barrier and you break through that, the other side is cash.
Right.
I mean, I'm a startup guy, right? Like I'm going to solve a problem. I'm going to get somebody to pay me for it. Right. So if I solve this problem, they're going to pay me for it. Or by extension, if I can help my customer solve this problem for them, they will pay me for it. And
right.
They will continue to pay me for it. So in its most sort of capitalistic viewpoint, there's a ton of money, like just a ton of cash sitting there. It's like you would want to have an untapped resource, right? Like this is a commodity that has been undervalued for a multitude of reasons, right? We don't even have to worry about the why. All we have to worry about is, okay, how do we then solve that? Like how do we put things and money vehicles in their hands to take advantage of that, right?
Yeah.
And that at its basic sort of function, that's how I look at it.
Well, and there, let's be really fair and honest and candid. I mean, there's a lot to distrust around banking.
Sure.
If you're a person of color. I mean, redlining, you know, the inability to get loans on the same terms as, yep, as people who are not of color, mm-hmm, or who are not female. So basically white men just get better deals. There's a real history there. So let me ask the question a little bit differently, which is, what do you hope that the next group of startup founders or the next group of innovators or technologists who can start to see people within the technology space of fintech that look more like them than maybe me, right? What does that mean and why is that so important?
So it's important that the technologists, and I'm glad you asked this question because this came up at the end of last year. CNN did a cover piece about Navy Federal Credit Union and finding that up to 50% of qualified black family applicants for mortgage loans were denied. And Navy Federal was like, hey, you know, it's a big oversight on our part. Well, 50%, that's a pretty big damn oversight.
It's a little bit more than an oversight.
Correct, yeah. Exactly. And so going back to, so if this is the problem, I would argue, or I would attempt to make the case that if you put technologists of color in those roles of working on the products, they would have, at the very least, that would be a concern that goes into what they build. Meaning, I'm going to build something. Part of it is I want to make sure that I can mitigate this as much as possible, right? So that's going to be a top level thesis for them as they're building their product. Because it was a top level thesis for Allison, right? We set out to solve a problem for smaller local banks. They have a unique set of issues. If we focus on those issues, we can then reasonably say we will have a product that can capture a good percentage of that market. But that's because I worked for a smaller bank. My grandmother was the head of HR for LaSalle Thompson Bank for like 29 years, right? So I knew going into it the challenges in terms of technology adoption that those type of banks have. I went into it intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So having technologists that, and look, I'll be honest with you, man, like, you know, we talk a lot about having, you know, folks of color in certain roles and so on and so forth. But like, I've got a ton of people that are not people of color that have supported us 1,000%. Sure. And so I think more so I care about the intention, right? Mm-hmm. Are you going to be intentional about solving these problems? And it starts with acknowledging them, right? And again, you know, you and I have had these conversations, so I know that, you know, you're very forward and candid with them. Not everyone is. And so if someone is intentional and going and has the interest to allow for a diverse technology group or a diverse technology company to come in and try to solve a problem, that's a great starting place.
Yeah, and I also go back to, there's an economic case for this, right? This isn't about ethics or DE&I or anything else you want to make it. There's just an economic argument, and it goes back to what you said earlier, which is there is this unserved, underserved population that no one is going after. And frankly speaking, there is economic benefit on both sides of that equation.
Absolutely.
For those folks. And so I do think it's one of those things where you have to start with recognizing that there is this, you know, this gap. And then the other part of it too is, however you need to rationalize that, and I'm not here to tell you how to do that,
correct,
but I am saying that there's an economic argument to be made for this. And so if for no other reason, solve it for capitalistic reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. Even the most cynical of us will look at the bottom line and say, hey, this makes us money.
Yeah. So one thing I always want to hear from founders is, you know, building a startup is a bit of a roller coaster ride.
No, really?
And I think that people from the outside think the roller coaster ride is like ups and downs over the course of like months or years. No, it's like before lunch.
Correct.
Right? Exactly. Like, I mean, 9 o'clock, I'm up by 9:30. I hit the low, and by, you know, hopefully by 10:15, I'm back on the rise. So I do think that for all founders, you have to go back to anchoring to something really important and kind of core to who you are. So for you as a founder, what has been the greatest personal benefit or gain that you've gotten out of this journey of building a startup?
Well, let me give you your flowers yet again. So I try to explain.
Not the point of this podcast. I swear there's been no money exchanged in any way, shape, or form for this.
All right, for this. Yes. So look, I think that's the biggest misconception of the startup roller coaster, right? We assume it's, over weeks or months or years, it's ups and downs. On a long enough timeline, it's really not that, right? On a day-to-day basis, absolutely. So I can have a call at 8 a.m., right? That call go amazing, right? To the point where we think, okay, great. This moves the needle for us. By noon, and I'm dead serious when I say this, by noon, it could absolutely be, oh man, like, did I make the right decision in starting this company? Am I the right person to lead this company? That's a span of 4 hours.
Right.
That's the roller coaster.
Right.
So going back to your question, how do you anchor, like, what do I use to anchor my thoughts? It's very simple. And it's three words. Embrace the suck. And that's the honest truth. So I played bass guitar throughout my childhood at various points. I put it down, never touched it for almost 20 years. Unfortunately, my mother passes away, and the connectivity between she and I was always music.
Oh, wow.
And so I said, hey, I want to get back into playing bass guitar. The first time I picked one up and tried to play it, it sounded horrible. And more importantly, I was frustrated at the fact that, man, you mean to tell me I did this every single day for like 5-6 years when I was a kid, and I'm this bad at it? Well, I don't want to do this. But then I took my professional mentality and moved it over to my personal life and said, Brian, embrace the suck. Today you're going to be terrible. 1,000 todays from today you're going to be terrible. It doesn't matter. Just do it. And that's really my attitude, is that irrespective of the outcome, I'm committed to figuring out the next step. And then we'll get to the next step after that, after we figure out this step. Mm-hmm. But I'm not worried about it. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to allow it to change my disposition. I'm not going to allow it to touch me personally. I'm not going to take it personally. And I'm just going to embrace this up.
So just tangentially, in case anybody out there doesn't know, if you ever want to always have a gig as a musician, play bass guitar.
That's so true.
It's like defense on a soccer team. You will be able to gig out as much as you want, probably more than you want, if you're even a competent bass player.
If you go to any forum on any of the socials, on any music gathering site, bass player wanted.
100%.
There is never...
Nobody's like, I need a new lead guitarist. I need a new rhythm guitarist. I need a drummer. You just don't see those, but it's like, need bass player.
That's right.
ASAP.
Tonight.
All right, so I'll bring this back in, but just word to the wise kids out there, if you want to gig out constantly, learn to play bass. So getting back to Allison, what's the next big thing for Allison? What does the immediate future look like, and what are you excited about?
So as I mentioned, you know, the regulatory landscape in the U.S. is forever changing. And there is even more political interest than there has been, I would say, in the last 30, 35 years, in terms of the federal government really sinking their teeth into the innovations that are being built. We just saw it last week, where we see that Capital One is about to acquire Discover. A lot of people see that as, you know, one major credit card company buying another. But they don't look at the regulatory implications of that, because now there's this huge book of business that this one entity already has with thousands of products that are being served to their customers. What are the short-term implications of what that means, right? So now you have opportunities for companies like Allison and companies that are building these sort of compliance-first products to see, hey, we can make sure that as you go through this diligence process, we are putting a layer of protection around your customers. So for us, we look at that. We champion stuff like that. I mean, I know the average consumer sees it and they're like, I don't know, because now you're going to have a quote unquote monopoly. But the negatives or the cons that come from things like that don't come from the top up. They come from the bottom down, because there hasn't been care put into the type of products that are put in the consumer's hands. Whereas a lot of these startup companies, because they have to be innovative, they have to offer good products and services, they have an opportunity now to embed themselves into those existing Discover or Capital One customers. And services like Allison now can play the middleman, right? The traffic cop, if you will. And so that's really what we're excited about. But ultimately, we want to continue to serve community banks. We want to continue to gather up more credit unions. And we almost want to build a network of these trusted entities that can then have the effect of being able to quickly onboard individuals, businesses, fintechs, whomever, and now has the federal government bought into the idea like, hey, you guys are doing a lot. Like, you guys are checking every box for us. Why don't we just mandate that all of our banks use you? I mean, great. That's not a problem that I would have any issue with. But, you know, you have to get there in steps. And I think that's really what the next, you know, 12 months for us is going to look like, is getting more of these smaller institutions together and then building this network of trust, really.
All right. So you're a huge Beatles aficionado.
Just a bit.
These are things I learn by getting to know you better. And you're also a cover band musician,
yes,
with said material, right?
That's right, yeah.
Are you playing bass,
yes,
in, yeah, that band?
So I'm bass, and though my voice probably doesn't project it right now because I'm getting over illness, but I'm also the lead singer.
Okay.
So
given that, what is your favorite, most obscure Beatles song that you think no one may know, and for some reason you just it sings to you?
Right. Well, it's hard just because I know that the you know, the Beatles are kind of polarizing, in that, you know, there are people that just love the Beatles and then people that think they're overrated. I fall into the camp of I've associated my life, the band that I associate my life with more closely has been the Beatles, right? And that's been the case since I was a little kid. Like I said, that was the connective tissue between my mom and I. She was a big McCartney lady, and I then inherited that love from McCartney. So a lot of the late, you know, 67 to like 70 Beatles stuff, I love all of that stuff. And then a lot of McCartney's Wings period, I love. But one of the songs that really, really, really talks to me is Blackbird. Right. Like I love Blackbird. My mother used to sing it to me when I was a little kid. And when you look at the sort of the background of the song, right, it's talking about the civil rights movement in the 1960s. The Beatles were actually the first major act to say, hey, we will not perform in a segregated venue. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. If you are going to segregate folks by race, we will not perform there. They were one of the first acts to do that. And like when you just look at just the amazingness of the courage that takes, because at that point the Beatles couldn't do any wrong. They could take money from anybody at that point. It's almost like a startup that says, all right, we've gotten a ton of early traction. We raised a bunch of capital. You've got this foreign entity that comes in and says, hey, we want to give you $10 million, right, on your cap, and we're only going to take like 1% of your cap table. Well, no, not really, because you don't represent the values that we represent as a company. So you turn the money down, right? It's not dissimilar to that, in that, you know, they could have said, no, we will perform in these segregated places and we don't care. No, they knew that their influences were people like Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry and, you know, B.B. King and Little Richard. And so they were like, no, we want to honor the people,
yeah,
that we love and respect. So we're going to follow that. So, yeah, so Blackbird is probably one of my favorite just songs in general. Like, I anytime I'm going through a rough day, I cut the lights out. I go on I got this little cubby at my house, and I just go on a little cubby. I listen to Blackbird, and I'm good. I'm back at it.
All right, follow-up question for that, because I want to know this maybe from my own kids. You're going to recommend one album for someone who's never listened to the Beatles to cut their teeth on. And I'm not talking about one song. I'm talking about the whole album.
Yeah.
I know what it was for me that got me into the Beatles, and I'll hold that until you answer, but I'd love your...
The political answer would be the Blue Album, The Best of the Beatles, from 1977 to 1970. That would be the political album. The political answer. The real answer is Rubber Soul. Like, I think if anyone, I don't care whether you like rap, whether you like country, whatever, you listen to Rubber Soul, you're gonna find something on there that you really, 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 really like. If you only like one song on there, you're gonna find something you're like, man, this is great. But I think Rubber Soul is must listen to for anyone that's never heard the Beatles or decides that they want to get into the Beatles.
Yeah, for me it was Sgt. Pepper.
Really?
It really was. Yeah, and it's just because I could listen to any single song and be really excited about listening to that song. Even the most, like Day in the Life, I think is one of the best songs ever.
One of the greatest songs ever written from literally from opening to ending. Like, yeah. You cannot go wrong with a Day in the
Life. I mean, even just the way they recorded it, like the sustain at the end, everybody thinks that they hit the piano chord and it just sustains for, 30 seconds.
That's right.
The actual recording of it is they're banging on a piano as hard as they can, and the sound engineer is just so very slowly moving the fader down until it so it's actually them banging on. So if you really listen closely to that recording, the original recording, not any remasters, you can actually tell that they're banging on it and they're fading it. But if I hadn't said that, or people didn't know that, they wouldn't listen for it.
But see that, and that's the they call them Easter eggs. But like, it's little things like that. Yeah. When you kind of listen to things, and then you get new information, and you go back. Right. You're like, wow, I had no idea, right? Like, so Hey Jude. And I know we said we're going to keep this profanity free, but there's a moment in Hey Jude where you can hear a loud profanity. I won't say what it is, but next time you listen to Hey Jude, about halfway through the song, just listen. You'll see a loud profanity. You're like, wow, I never noticed that.
Yeah.
And it's like these little pieces where you're like, man, like I never, like the Beatles, they broke up 60 years ago. And they, or I guess more than 60 years ago at this point, but, or I guess almost 60 years ago. And they're still giving like these new little nuggets. And it's a really dope experience.
Yeah. For anybody who's not familiar, A Day in the Life was We Didn't Start the Fire. Before We Didn't Start the Fire was a thing.
I would say that's accurate.
So if you really get the background and the history of A Day in the Life, like you start to understand that it was basically the predecessor to some of those more politically kind of active songs. So, all right, Brian, I appreciate you being on here. But before we go, where can people find you? Where can they find Allison on the web, on socials?
So we're getting ready to launch, as you mentioned, to coincide with our new product release. We're getting ready to relaunch the website, tryallison.com. Tryallison.ai also will be an available domain. To follow me, my handle is always Fintech Brian. So Fintech Brian on X, Fintech Brian on LinkedIn, Fintech Brian on Facebook, all that good stuff. My thing is I know that regulatory law and the statutes around it is not sexy, but that's what that's the stuff that I really nerd out on, and I think that's where the opportunity for us is. So if anybody ever wants to talk shop, just reach out and we'll have a chat.
Yeah, appreciate it. Brian, thanks so much for being on the show.
I mean, this was fun. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Absolutely.